NATO defence ministers are gathering in Brussels at the start of 2 days of talks where they're expected to discuss providing Ukraine with further systems to help prevent attacks from Russia. At least 19 people were killed and many more injured when Russian missiles hit multiple regions across Ukraine on Monday, including in the capital Kyiv. Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky said the country urgently needed more advanced weaponry to create an air shield. Well, I've been speaking to Shawshank Joshi, defence editor of The Economist. I asked him what additional air defences might be sent to Ukraine.
Some of the systems are on their way to Ukraine. Germany promised its IRIS-T system back in June. That isn't operational anywhere, including in Germany, so Ukraine's going to get the first system. In fact, we saw, the first actual battery arrive on October 11th, in other words, yesterday. We're also due to have deliveries of a Norwegian design system but supplied by America called NASAMS, N-A-S-A-M, and that's currently used, I think, to protect parts of Washington, D.C. airspace. It's actively in use in the United States. That is on the way. I think it's still going to take a little bit of time. It takes quite a while to train Ukrainians on these systems. So these weapons are on their way. The only problem is it's taken a long time, and they aren't going to cover all of the sites that Ukraine has to protect. It's an enormous country. There are lots of cities. There are lots of vital military sites, depots, hubs, command posts. And Russia ultimately has a fair few missiles. And so this is going to mitigate the problem. It isn't going to create some sort of impermeable shield over Ukraine.
And in terms more broadly of the supply of military material to Ukraine, is it the case that the United States is still doing the heavy lifting on this? Is Washington, are the Americans looking for other NATO members to do more?
There's no doubt that the US is doing the lion's share. There is some data that's not, it's not perfect, but it's calculated by the Kiel Institute for the World Economy in Germany. And I think what we see is that if you look at all the pledges from August 4th to October 3rd, so it's sort of summer and onwards, the US made new pledges of weapons of about 12 billion euros, making its total to 52 billion. And what we see from EU countries over that same period is they expanded commitments only by about 1.4 billion euros, and their collective commitments are 29 billion, but they haven't reached all of that, of course. So there's a huge asymmetry. And I think, yes, there are voices in the US, particularly as they approach the midterm elections, a more politically sensitive period, that says, well, you know, this is a European crisis. Why are we providing the absolute lion's share of kit for Ukraine, even though this is a matter of life and death for many Europeans?
So this imbalance, if you like, or at least that's maybe what it's seen as, this imbalance is going to potentially create political difficulties for President Biden as he tries to keep the supply of material flowing.
I think so. There's an expectation the Republicans will take the House of House of Representatives in the U.S. congressional elections, which are their midterms next month. And Republicans in general, it's one of the strange things of the last few years, are generally more skeptical of NATO these days. They're more skeptical of allies. They think that aid to Ukraine has been excessive and needs to be choked off, that the U.S. is overcommitting. Indeed, some people also think that actually more needs to be done on China rather than Russia. So I think this is going to create a problem as the months go on, as the winter gets tougher. Of course, Europe is in a different boat. Europe is in a more militarily difficult situation to begin with. Many of its armed forces don't have the same levels of stockpiles to give. And some countries which have stockpiles, including my country, the UK, have actually eaten so deeply into them that I don't think they can keep up this rate of support for, you know, forever and ever. It's going to run dry at some stage.
What about this warning yesterday on the eve of the NATO meeting from NATO General Secretary Jens Stoltenberg, warning the Kremlin, warning Russia that sabotage on NATO member states would be regarded, sabotage by Russian forces on NATO member states would be regarded as an attack on a NATO member state?
Well, it's a warning that you can understand him issuing. We've just had explosions in the Baltic Sea against the Nord Stream 1 and 2 pipelines that are widely attributed to Russia, though there's no hard evidence yet. And in the past, we've also seen, you know, Eastern Europe, particularly Poland, is becoming a major hub for arms shipments to Russia, for arms shipments to Ukraine. And so there's huge concern that Russia could target that. What I would emphasize is it wouldn't be the first time it's happened. In the past 10 years, we have seen Russian intelligence officers and agents effectively conduct sabotage explosions against ammunition dumps in Bulgaria and the Czech Republic. Now, what's notable is A, that happened in the past, and B, it didn't provoke a NATO response. We didn't declare Article 5, although, of course, there were expulsions of Russian spies across Europe. So I think that there's a concern in Europe that Russia could escalate in this way as it becomes more reckless, as it may already have done in the Baltic Sea, and that there's a difficulty in sort of working out what's the level that would reach an armed attack. Because if they just, you know, sort of sabotaged one factory somewhere in a relatively modest way, it might not reach that threshold. And that the challenge is always, how do you signal credibility and resolve whilst understanding that actually not every country is going to want to go to war with Russia simply because one factory explodes?
And just a final question, as we enter the winter months, Shawshank, how do you see events unfolding on the front line in Ukraine over the next number of weeks, over the next several weeks, as the armies on both sides, I presume, face more difficult conditions as winter bites?
Well, in the next few weeks, winter won't bite so much that it will stop offensive operations. That's going to take a lot longer. The Ukrainians still have the initiative. They still have the momentum. They're still pressing their advantages in the east, in Luhansk province, and in the south, in Kherson province. I do think it's looking in the last few days like these progress in these places is slowing down. But I think the Russian lines are weak. The Russian lines are demoralized. The effect of mobilization hasn't been felt. And I think the Ukrainians may still hope that putting huge pressure on these demoralized, weak lines, with ammunition supplies down, depots exploding, logistics in trouble, that they can still make further territorial advances before winter really sets in and before the effect of these new Russian reservists is fully felt. I think they will still feel a sense of optimism on that front.
And that was Shawshank Joshi, defense editor of The Economist.